How much of what lawmakers say on social media sites impact debate at the Iowa State House? This is River to River on Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Clay Masters. Social media is influencing some debate here at the Capitol. The governor's office has posted a YouTube video to help drum up public support for his education reform proposal. In the first half of the show, we'll talk with the communications director for Governor Branstad, a political science professor at the University of Northern Iowa, and Des Moines Register columnist Kathy Obradovich. Then in the second half, we'll talk with lawmakers charged with negotiating education reform in Iowa to see if they're getting any closer to a compromise. Join in on the conversation after this news. This is River to River on Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Clay Masters. Many reporters and journalists spend a lot of time tweeting and updating social media sites. It's just another platform that, in the constantly changing industry, pursuing to get information out quicker in this 24-hour news climate we live in. It happens every day here at the State House. But what about lawmakers here in Iowa? Some have been tweeting and using Facebook during debate. The governor's office recently put out a video set to the tune of Jackson 5's ABC. The words, they say they want education funding and reform, flash across the screen, and then we see Democratic lawmakers on the floor of the Senate saying things like, if you want world-class schools in Iowa, you've got to pay for it. Here, we'll listen to a little bit of that video.
For all of the kids in Iowa, you gotta pay for it. Okay, Governor, if that's your choice, then 4% is the price of education reform.
In a meeting that only lasted 5 minutes, House Republicans offered a compromise on education reform.
We would be willing to consider for fiscal year 14 a 2% increase in allowable growth plus a 2% one-time equivalent payment on top of that.
Plus another 4% in 2015.
Finally, at the end, it says, share this video with your friends on Facebook and Twitter. And it almost feels like something you'd see during a campaign. But this isn't a campaign, or is it? We're talking about a debate on the issue, but the appeal is definitely to the public. Tim Albrecht, Communications Director for the Branstad Administration, is with me here in the State House Law Library. Tim, tell us about the inspiration behind this video.
Well, this video really goes to where people are using the internet right now, and that is on social media networks, and they like to watch videos. And the best way to get across somebody's own words is to show them in their own words. It's so much more effective than simply sending out a typewritten release over email. This actually had some energy and some heart behind it. And let me tell you, we're almost 1 week since the release of that video. We're still talking about it. There have been 2,000 views on that video. But most importantly, the day after the video came out, Senate Democrats came with their counter proposal after one full week of stonewalling. So it's been effective. Iowans like it. They're sharing it. And we're proud of it.
And River to River listeners, we've posted that on our Facebook page. You can comment on it on our Facebook site. Call us at 866-780-9100. Do you follow any legislators? Do you follow the governor? Please call 866-780-9100. Tim, who's the audience for this? You talked a little bit about you're trying to get this out to the way that people are using social media. So are you trying to just reach out to other Republicans, to Democrats? Are you trying to facilitate some kind of conversation here?
We're trying to facilitate compromise because in the legislature, education reform was at a standstill and it really wasn't moving anywhere. So we wanted to make sure that Iowans knew what was going on in their legislature. We wanted to make sure they knew that they could contact their legislators, in this case, Senate Democrats, if they wanted to really get things moving. But the whole point of the video is to show that Senate Democrats said the price of reform is 4% growth in school aid this year, 4% growth in school aid next year, and that's the price of reform. When that was offered, well, all of a sudden they're stonewalling, and we wanted to say, wait, you know, if this if these are the parameters and you're going to move them, we're putting them back in place through the video.
If your goal is to get education reform through a bipartisan legislature, is this video going to help get that done?
We've already seen two counter proposals, one from Senate Democrats that moved a little bit toward the House Republicans, one from House Republicans that moved a little bit toward Senate Democrats. So we believe that less than a week after this video was released, there's no reason why we can't get education reform this week.
We have a couple other guests I want to get to as well and bring in on the conversation. Chris Larimer, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa, is on the phone. Chris, thanks for being here. Chris Larimer, are you there? We also have Des Moines Register columnist Kathy Obradovich also joining us by phone. Kathy, thanks for being on River to River today.
Hi, Clay. Happy to be here.
And so hopefully we can get Chris connected in a moment. But Kathy, have you had a chance to look at the video? Do you have any thoughts on this video and what kind of what it's doing?
Yeah, I mean, you know, this kind of video is done in politics all the time. And it does not surprise me that the governor's office is using this medium now. They have worked on bringing their political communications into the 21st century just like everybody else. You know, I think that the thing that surprised me perhaps a little bit about the video was that they did this under the official governor's office communication. A lot of times when you see sort of overtly political types of communication, they're doing it in cooperation or in partnership with the state party or a caucus, political caucus group, or some other political ally, as opposed to doing it essentially under the governor's official stationery.
Chris Larimer, also want to ask, what do you make of the governor's video?
Well, I think it, yeah, first of all, thanks for having me, and always good to talk to Tim and Kathy. You know, I think it does what Tim indicated earlier, is that it keeps attention, right? I mean, this is the way the information is communicated now. You know, it provides a deeper sense of connection than something, as Tim said, just a piece of paper. I mean, if you're talking about keeping people involved in politics, that's actually, as people work on campaigns, that's pretty hard to do. But this is a little bit more intimate form. This is a little flashier form. And so, if the idea is to keep attention, it's entirely effective.
We have a listener question for Tim wondering, do you use social media to track the issues? Is it helpful for understanding what's at stake, or is it a politicizing distraction?
You know, we do use social media. In fact, one of the reasons I was brought onto the Branstad campaign originally is because the last time he had run was in 1994 when they were still sending press releases via fax machine. Now, in the age of Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, where everybody has a video camera or a still camera on their phone, he wanted somebody who was really going to utilize social media. And when he brought me into the administration, I did so here as well and continue to do so. We use TweetDeck. We follow the hashtag IAGov. We follow the hashtag IALedges. And we do follow the trends and what people are talking about so that we can have a good idea, a good sense of what Iowans want to talk about, what Iowans are saying that they need. Because, you know, all too often in the past, people in Des Moines under the Golden Dome would tend to kind of forget about those of us in Northwest Iowa, for instance, where I come from. But this gives us a direct pipeline, an immediate pipeline to the people of Iowa.
Chris and Kathy, curious, what do you make of social media use, all of it, during a legislative session? Is it catered to those that just are under the Golden Dome, or does it reach out effectively to those looking at their smartphones or looking at their computers? Kathy, what have you seen in your reporting and writing for the Des Moines Register?
I would say it's all of the above, Clay. You've got a group of people who are in the Capitol who are essentially tweeting to each other. So, you know, I've seen legislators, lobbyists, and reporters who are essentially communicating with each other on Twitter about what's going on in the State House. People like to follow meetings on Twitter. You know, they can't be in every meeting that's going on simultaneously, so they follow things on their smartphones. But then there's also a political communication that goes on outside the building. And one example I've seen in the past week that came from Democrats was a protest against Senator Dennis Booth who made some controversial comments about homosexuality on the floor of the Senate. And I have seen a Facebook campaign protesting his comments that have been forwarded by Democratic senators and others. And I would say that that audience is probably mostly outside the Capitol.
Yeah, I know. I tweeted something about that myself, and it was interesting to see how many different people that have no connection to Iowa even were retweeting it. So it's a way of getting stuff maybe that's going on underneath the Golden Dome, so to speak, out there to the rest of the public. Chris, what do you think about the overall use of Twitter and Facebook, these different social media sites, and its effectiveness towards getting information out to the general public, to the taxpayer, to the voter?
Well, you know, I mean, it's going out to different blocks of voters, but what I think it does is provide an opportunity to get that information to people who maybe normally wouldn't necessarily seek out that information. And so, you know, particularly for younger students or for college students, a younger voting population, they may not necessarily, you know, be following something on the internet or, you know, waiting for it to come out in the newspaper. But if there's, you know, a Twitter feed, if there's something on Facebook about it, maybe they're more likely to follow what's going on in the state house than they would otherwise. And, you know, certainly for class exercises, for teaching purposes, you know, Twitter and those types of things are actually very useful because I feel like students are, you know, maybe more likely to follow what's happening on a day-to-day basis. Whereas if they were just waiting for it to come out in the newspaper or waiting for a press release, what have you, they may not be as likely to follow what's going on. So I think it does provide an opportunity to sort of increase the level of awareness of what's going on in the state house.
One of the Democratic senators featured in that video then brought the video up on the floor and then called on Governor Branstad to pass 4% funding. And then Iowa Senate Democrats tweeted the senator's response in a video. Now, this is a complex issue with a lot of moving parts. I mean, does it do much good boiling it down to 140 characters on Twitter and then posting video of floor debate? I mean, does that just add noise or does that inform the public?
Well, I mean, it adds a little bit of noise, sure, but I mean, it at least gets the conversation going. I mean, certainly for a younger group of voters, just getting that conversation started is really the hard part, just getting people initially engaged. And so I think what Twitter and Facebook and other social media can do is get that first step where you get people initially engaged, then they're going to be more likely to come back to it again and again.
Well, and the simpler the message, the better for politics. The issue of allowable growth is complicated, but when you boil it down, as is done in these exchange of videos, you're really forced to boil it down on Twitter in 140 characters to a very basic message. Now, is the issue more complicated than it appears in political communication? Almost always, regardless of whatever the forum is, almost always the actual facts of a situation are more complicated than what you're getting in the political message. But the political message is what people can remember and then pass on to other people.
We're talking about Twitter. There are quite a few senators, as well as the governor and the lieutenant governor, that are on Twitter. And some are calling into question whether or not what's being said on Twitter violates some rules of decorum here at the State House. Last month, outside of the Twitter sphere, if you will, last month, Senator Rob Hoag, a Democrat from Cedar Rapids, was warned about violating Senate decorum by Senate President Pam Yoakum. This is on the floor. The exchange came during debate over whether to create a new state agency for emergency management. And let's hear a bit of the exchange. Again, this is not done on Twitter, but this was actually out of the mouths of the people that are on the floor. We're going to hear a little bit of that exchange.
And you know what Governor Branstad offered? Zero from state government. And so it's really easy for people to do a good job when you just ignore it and don't think it's something you need to do.
Rule 9 was invoked. Senators, please refrain from questioning other members or other people in this building's motives. Let's be respectful. Thank you. Senator Hoag, you are in order.
Thank you, Madam President. And I apologize if people thought that was too harsh.
So Rule 9 was evoked. Kathy Obradovich, you've covered politics and lawmaking here at the State House for a while. What is Rule 9?
Well, Rule 9 is one of a set of rules of decorum that the Senate has very traditionally used in operation. And as you heard Senate President Pam Yoakum say, it relates to not publicly questioning the motives of another legislator, or in this case, it extended to the governor. And that is, it is a rule of civility that happens on the floor of the Senate. I don't think that tweets sent out by lawmakers during debate would fall under this rule. But it is something that is, I think, you know, part of the tradition of the Senate, and they it's sort of like, you know, you have to wear a coat and tie on the floor of the Senate. Most of society is a little bit more informal these days, but they've kept these rules as a tradition.
So just to read some of the tweets, especially during the Senate's debate over Medicaid, taking the Medicaid expansion, which is one of the big issues that faces lawmakers here, whether or not to adapt an expansion of Medicaid or the governor's Healthy Iowa plan. Republican Senator Kent Sorensen tweeted, "People that believe we have unlimited federal dollars must live in the land of leprechauns and unicorns." Senator Rick Bertrand, a Republican as well, during that same debate, mentioned Senator Jack Hatch, a Democrat from Des Moines, wondering whether or not the senator was thinking about his future aspirations as a running for governor. He wrote, "As Senator Hatch dreams of Terrace Hill, Iowa property taxpayers live the nightmare of ongoing tax increases to support ongoing government programs." So I guess, Chris Larimer, what's the difference here between what gets said on Twitter versus what gets said on the floor?
Well, I think, I mean, you have to obviously abide by the rules of the Senate that Kathy mentioned on the floor, and you have to be a little bit more professional. But what gets said on Twitter is an attempt to reach out to a certain block of voters. I mean, you're trying to sort of mobilize activists, mobilize supporters, mobilize those folks who are going to be on your side for the ensuing policy debate. So you're trying to, with Twitter, you're trying to shape public opinion probably in a way that's maybe a bit more effective than what you're going to say in formal comments on in the Senate chamber.
Tim Albrecht.
You know, Clay,
go ahead, Kathy.
I was just going to say, I would liken these tweets to being sort of similar to a press release that a senator might email out after a debate to react to what's going on. It's just a lot more immediate. Now, the tone of these tweets are more informal and maybe sharper than they would actually send out under their letterhead as a press release. But I think they need to keep in mind that their tweets do reflect on the office and not just them personally. So, you know, perhaps it's gone a little bit beyond that as far as being the pointed tone of it.
Well, and I think, you know, if we think about how people process political information, for the most part, people are going to follow people who they already agree with. And so these tweets are going to be harsh, but, you know, they're not going to, for the most part, they're not going to upset people unless you have people who are going to follow someone that they dislike, which, you know, some people do. Some people follow kind of both Republicans and Democrats, but for the most part, you're following people you like, similar to Facebook. And so that sort of format allows you to kind of go beyond what you would normally say in a legislative chamber.
River to River listeners, do you follow the issues on social media? Is it helpful or is it political noise? Tweet us at IPR Talk or on Facebook at Iowa Public Radio, or call us at 866-780-9100. Tim Albrecht, Communications Director for the Governor's Office, how would you weigh into the conversation here about whether or not what people are saying on Twitter, or what the governor is saying on Twitter, how people are interpreting that?
Well, Clay, you and I sit here in the beautiful law library of the Iowa State Capitol, and we're surrounded by volumes and volumes of bound books that contain legislative code and laws and rules and all of these things that we discuss on a daily basis. And if I were to get up, walk across the table, find the book that I need, find the citation that I need, and then try to explain it to somebody, you could have 15 tweets in that amount of time that would boil it down to where people are. And that's the point of social media and engaging your political figures and elected officials in social media, because you're occupying the space that exists for such a conversation.
Kathy, have you ever used a Twitter quote or something used on social media, a quote in one of your columns or your reporting?
I have quoted tweets. Senator Grassley, for example, is famous for his tweets. And so nationally, his tweets get quoted. You have to be careful about how you do it. I would say, a tweet from Senator Grassley's account or something like that, because unless you know for sure that the person is tweeting himself or herself, you have to be careful about the attribution. But tweets are certainly fair game for reporters to, and they will end up in other formats.
And Chris Larimer, are you addressing your students and talking about the use of social media when they enter the political landscape, or when they go off and graduate and are doing something in the realm of their profession?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. We certainly use it in class. So if I teach an Iowa politics class, I have a number of people I recommend that students follow. Tim Albrecht, Kathy Obradovich, Jason Noble, Clay Masters, Iowa Public Radio, as a way to sort of stay engaged with what's going on, and as a way to kind of see both sides of an issue and how both sides view a particular issue. So absolutely, I think students should use social media as much as they can, but obviously also be a bit careful about, how you're posting certain things.
So, Chris, are there instances in which Twitter has gotten a politician in trouble, specifically here in Iowa, or any national examples you can think of?
There have been, occasionally there are these deleted tweets that try to pop up. Certainly Senator Grassley, I don't know if he's necessarily gotten in a lot of trouble, but he's certainly had some interesting tweets, whether they're one-character tweets or, assume deer dead type tweets where he talks about hitting a deer on Highway 136. They could certainly get you into trouble, but it's hard to know what the long-term implication is there, really.
And then we can also think back to what happened with Anthony Weiner too long ago.
Yeah, absolutely. That was an extreme case, but now, he's trying to come back and considering a run for mayor of New York. And so, I think this stuff is still a bit in the early stages. From a political science perspective, I think where the really interesting part is, obviously people are using this and following Twitter, following social media, and they're becoming aware of certain issues or aware of different sides of an issue. But the early part of the research is really on what are the behavioral implications. So can you use Twitter to get people out to vote? If you send them a reminder via Twitter or a reminder via text, can you get people out to vote? There have been some projects on this, and the evidence so far is mixed, but I think that's really where it's going. There's been some work on Facebook, so if you post something about voting on Facebook, you're more likely to vote, and I think that's where you can really see changes in what happens in the political process, because if you're changing who participates based on social media, you can change kind of public policy.
Tim, are you seeing social media make a difference?
Absolutely. We have something called hashtag Skype Your School on Twitter, where the governor and lieutenant governor Skype with schools all across the state, and that's been enormously popular. We also engage people via the hashtag AskIAGov. Both of these really revolutionary in terms of social media, and it's been effective both there and on Facebook.
Okay, we have about 30 seconds. Kathy Obradovich, I want to ask you, too, are you seeing social media make a difference in who you're covering?
Oh, yeah. I do think that that legislators who are on social media, who are engaged in that way, are also probably really effective communicators in other forums. And so you see that extend to social media. They know how to get attention. They know how to get their message out. And that helps them get media coverage.
Okay. Thanks so much. We'll be back after the break to talk about education reform and progress. This is River to River on Iowa Public Radio News. This is River to River on Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Clay Masters. Senate Democrats and House Republicans seem to be close to a compromise on reforming Iowa's education system. Last week, Democrats accepted an offer Republicans made to increase general school funding, but they still wanted to boost teacher pay and offer leadership incentives to educators. Republicans in the House came back with an offer. And now this morning, during his regular Monday morning press conference, Governor Terry Branstad seemed hopeful to get education reform resolved soon. Here's a clip from what he said this morning.
And we've had a major breakthrough on that. Republicans made a bold offer, and the Democrats came up with a counteroffer. Republicans have said there's a number of things that are acceptable, some other things that they need to have. We need to make sure that we have education reform and accountability in addition to the additional 4% state aid that is included in this package. But I'm very hopeful this week we can get education reform resolved.
And that's Governor Terry Branstad this morning during his Monday press conference with reporters. With me here in the Iowa Statehouse Law Library is Representative Ron Jorgensen, a Republican from Sioux City. He's the chair of the House Education Committee, and Senator Herman Kornbach, a Democrat from Ames, and the chair of the Senate Education Committee. Thanks to both you gentlemen for being on the show today.
Thank you for inviting us.
Thanks for having us.
River to River listeners, are you following the debate over education reform? What are you hoping for in a final bill? And do you believe reform will be approved this year? Give us a call, 866-780-9100. Join the conversation. We're on Facebook and Twitter. You can find us at Iowa Public Radio on Facebook or tweet us at IPR Talk. And so we just heard the governor tell us what he's hopeful. He's hopeful for something getting resolved this week. Senator Kornbach, how do you see things progressing this week?
Well, the Senate last week in our counterproposal addressed three issues that in our conference committee discussions last week we had identified as being central and core to the reform proposal, the whole reform effort. Those three central issues are Iowa Learning Online, which is how we provide online courses to students in the public schools, Teach Iowa, which is the governor's initiative to help encourage more good young people to come into the teaching profession, and the teacher leadership mentor models that are going to be helpful in taking our already wonderful teachers and making them even better. Last week in the conference committee, we tried to engage the Republicans in the discussion on these issues. Frankly, we didn't get very far. So Thursday, as part of our counteroffer, we agreed to give them the House language on the first two of those, the Iowa Learning Online and the Teach Iowa. In return, we asked them to accept the Senate language only on the third point, on the teacher leadership models. There are also two key funding issues. One is allowable growth, which is the increase in the ongoing base funding for our public schools. And the other one is the class size reduction early intervention money. That's a program that's been in place for a dozen years. Unfortunately, that's set to sunset at the end of June. We need to continue that. Now, the Republicans last week had offered something along the way, along the lines of allowable growth. It isn't a true and honest 4% increase. It's 2% increase in the base funding and a one-time payment of an additional 2%, which they would then take back the following year. So it really isn't an honest 4%. And the Legislative Service Agency, when they ran the numbers, they found that the Republican offer is $114 million short of what the Democrats had been asking for. Notwithstanding that, we recognize that they have come up from the even lower level that they had been proposing before. So we acknowledge that. We agreed to come down to their level on allowable growth, but we must insist that the class size reduction money be continued on a permanent basis. Our schools have been using that to reduce class size, to help hire additional teachers and teaching staff, to help early grade learners get a good start in school. We agreed to their allowable growth proposal. Now we ask them to accept our class size reduction proposal. So we've given them language on several areas. We ask them to accept on three areas. We ask them to accept our language on two.
Representative Jorgensen, at the outset of this week, how do you think will we be celebrating education reform passed in the state by Friday?
Well, I hope so. I mean, that's my objective, too, and I have the utmost respect for Senator Kornbach, and my goal is to continue to work through the process and to get something resolved, as the governor even mentioned, this week. I think it's very important that school districts know what their funding level is going to be by the end of this week, and so that would be my objective also. And in any compromise and negotiations, it's going to be a give and take. We felt that we started out with a proposal that was 2% allowable growth or state supplemental aid, whichever way you want to describe it. both in 2 years, and then also having the reform initiative that invests about $160 million in education. We understood and listened to the Senate's desire and need and essentially demands in some cases for 4%. And so we crunched the numbers and felt that we can still provide the 4% in both years. Granted, the first year is at 2% and 2% because we want to be sure that we're still abiding by our budgeting principles of saying that ongoing expenses are only funded by ongoing revenues. And so that was, for the most part, what we needed to do to abide by those principles without taking money from other areas within the state budget also that are also very highly needed. So we did that. We compromised on the early intervention block grant program. We normally have that in the standings bill, and we agreed to do that through this bill for a two-year period. Last year, we extended it for 1 year, and so we've added another year on top of that to be in line with the two-year budget process. In addition to that, we compromised on a number of other issues, the minimum pay going from $32,000 up to $33,005. And we also took the Senate language on a number of initiatives, eliminating the marketing program, but picking up competency-based provisions within the Senate language, the Senate language on preschool funding uses, the Senate language on kindergarten assessment, the Senate language on school district reporting requirements, the Senate language on instructional hours, and then agreeing to work in perfecting the bill on other areas as it relates to the evaluation process and so forth.
Senator Kornbach, I know that many times when we talked about the education reform, you said that the center, the key to that reform is the teacher leadership models. And the Senate plan had four different models to choose from. The Republican plan made it optional, made the one plan optional. Is that really the sticking point here? Is that what this debate's coming down to?
I think that's the key issue that we need to focus in on resolving now. The Republican position is kind of interesting. They say that this teacher leadership model is vital, but then they turn around and say it's going to be optional. And when the Legislative Service Agency ran the numbers on what it would cost to implement that and compared that to what the local districts were going to get under the House proposal, they found the 214 school districts would not get enough money from the state in order to pay for the program. So when you make something optional and then you underfund it, how many school districts are really going to adopt that? I think the answer is very few. So if this program really is vital, as the Republicans have been saying, and I think that there's a lot of potential there for professional development for teachers, then let's stay with the governor's original plan to make it mandatory. Let's make sure we fund it adequately. And let's do one more thing. Let's listen to our school superintendents, who have told us over and over and over again they need flexibility in how to implement it. The governor's plan is an interesting plan, and I think it may work for some districts, but it won't work for other districts. Moreover, there are a lot of districts that have already gone a considerable distance down the road with their own model for teacher professional development. We don't want to push them back to square one when they've already made substantial progress. So that's why we developed additional models. Actually, we have three models, and then we have instructions for districts. If they don't like any of the three that they can adopt on their own, then they can design their own, and there's a state commission set up to approve the models that would be proposed by individual districts. I think that that's a comprehensive approach. We're going to make it mandatory, we're going to pay for it, and then we're going to give schools a lot of choice and flexibility. The key thing in all of this is getting our local districts to embrace this idea. I don't think there's one path to getting this job done. But you have to have the school districts embrace it. They have to believe in it. They have to make it their own. And giving them the ability to make that choice, that's key.
River to River listeners, what are you hoping for in a final education reform bill? Call us at 866-780-9100. We're on Facebook at Iowa Public Radio, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. We'll go to our first caller for the second half, Jay in Mitchell. Jay, what are your thoughts?
Just kind of curious, what is Senator Kornbach here? In terms of the policy pieces coming out of the Senate, what do you guys got in there for some of our small rural school districts? I see, you know, we got an urban education network and those folks. What do you got for the smaller districts in Iowa on your policy side?
Well, that's exactly what I was talking about, Jay, with regard to the choice of different models. The governor's plan is a very detailed. They have five different levels of teacher responsibility and additional pay and a whole lot of things in there. And I think that might work reasonably well for a large school district, especially if they hadn't already adopted their own model. But for the smaller districts with a smaller number of teachers, they don't have the flexibility to implement the governor's detailed plan. So that's why we want to make it possible for districts to design their own, to give them choices of several other models, but also to allow them to design their own so they can choose something that fits their schools and the teaching staff that they have and the ability of their local schools to afford it.
Representative Jorgensen, for rural school districts, making it an optional teacher leadership program, is that what kind of impact would that have on the more rural populations, rural schools, making it optional? They have less money, or how would the...
No, you know, we feel the program is adequately funded, but we want to make sure that there are no unfunded mandates with this initiative. And we're confident with the funding levels that we have and the ability for each school district to make that decision on their own, whether it works for them or not. But also on our comparable plan, you know, there is an option that if the governor's framework plan doesn't work, they can come back to the department with an alternative plan that works for them. We're very confident that that's going to happen. And having only two plans is really all we need. We want to make sure the program is sustainable in the long run. It gives local districts control of what they do. But it also provides the funding that they need to accomplish those objectives. The other initiatives, especially for rural areas, relates to the Iowa Learning Online initiative. And I think that's one area where both of us, for the most part, agree that that's an important thing for some school districts that maybe don't have the resources to offer some of the courses that maybe large districts do, that we want to invest in a program that increases the coursework that's offered for some of those school districts that might not be able to have full-time teachers teaching it.
So you're saying you're confident that there won't be that there won't be any unfunded mandates then?
Well, if that's up to the school district on what they want to do, but we're going to have a program that is adequately funded and that provides them the choice on whether they want to get into it. We're confident that it's a three-year phase-in, too. So they could wait two or three years to see how this thing is working with others to make their own decision. But that should be a decision that they make on whether they want to enter the program or not. Although, like I said, I'm pretty confident most will.
Well, the Legislative Service Agency analysis does not support that conclusion. Like I said, 214 school districts would be underwater under the Republican proposal, that they would not get enough money under the Republican funding proposal in order to implement the governor's plan. So that's why we provided alternative models. We also have one key feature in our proposal, which is basically a hold harmless language. We say that school districts only have to implement as much of their whichever model they choose, they only have to implement as much of it as they get state funds to pay for. So we are absolutely guaranteed against any kind of unfunded mandates.
Representative Jorgensen.
Yeah, I'd just like to respond to that because we must be looking at different LSA reports because the most recent one that I looked at on our model showed that 128 districts would be, quote, underwater. And when that same agency did an analysis of the Senate proposal, from their overall report, it said that within two of the Senate models, that 54% or 187 districts would have costs in excess of the allocation given to them on one model, and then the other model, 224 districts or 64% would have costs that exceed that. So and the other thing to remember on the LSA models, whether it relates to our model or the Senate's model, is they use what I would consider the worst-case scenario, where they're assuming that for a teacher that is outside the classroom 50% of the time or 25% of the time, they are replaced with another teacher. And in many cases, a school district would have the ability to move teachers around so they didn't have to hire a one-on-one type of situation, or they could work on an agreement with a local AEA to provide that instruction. So we're confident that once school districts get into this, look at their own personal models, that they can make this work. And if not, again, in the unlikely situation that they can't, then they can opt out of the program for the short term anyway.
And is this a new report from LSA that you're referencing, or is this one?
Well, this is the most recent one when we had created our plan.
Okay. Daniel writes, why can we find plenty of money to pay coaches for extracurricular activities but cannot find money for teacher mentor programs? One of you want to take a stab at that?
Sure, I will. I think that our state treasury is in good shape. We've been through some rough years, and the schools have had to sacrifice. The last 3 years, as far as allowable growth, were 2%, 0%, and 2%. It's the worst three-year period in any of the 40-year history of allowable growth. There's never before been a zero year. But because our state economy is coming back, our tax revenues have been increasing at a nice rate, we can afford 4%, and the schools need 4% for allowable growth. That's why we chose that number. We listened to our school superintendents. We surveyed them. 81% said they needed 4%. Now, we've compromised to that at a little bit under that number, but I certainly don't need to go any lower. The other thing we absolutely need to have is the class size reduction money. That's $30 million a year. That's equivalent to about 1% of allowable growth. That program has been successful in reducing class sizes across the state. The number, the funding for that has been stagnant for 10 years. While the enrollment in kindergarten through third grade has increased 7.7%, and teacher salaries have gone up about 3% a year. So it's 34% more expensive to hire teachers, and you have 8% more kindergarten through third graders, but we aren't funding that class size reduction with any more money than we did a decade ago. That's why we need to make that permanent, and we need to increase the funding.
The 81% of school district administrators that you referenced a lot, that you had surveyed, have you heard anything from them since the 15th when the dates need budgets needed to be set? Have you been in contact with them?
I'm in constant contact with my own local school superintendent, and I've heard from a variety of others. Pretty much all of the stakeholder groups say you need to fight for 4%.
So are they then now left with not knowing what they have next year to work with for teachers?
I think we pretty much agreed on that piece of it. We need to focus on the teacher leadership models.
Representative Jorgensen, have you been talking with school districts in your area? What are you hearing?
Oh, yes. I visit quite frequently with superintendents in Sioux City and Sergeant Bluff. And, in fact, the superintendent in Sioux City has publicly come out and said that he does support the House plan for reform. You know, we are going to invest, when this thing is fully implemented, over $400 million of additional state dollars than what we're spending right now into education. And we feel it's very important for that type of investment that we spend it as widely and effectively and efficiently as possible, so we get the results that we want, not continuing to just fund something to get the results that we have had in the past. You know, I have no problem investing in education, but it needs to be done on a targeted basis that will get us the results that we need.
By making it optional for them taking the teacher leadership programs, who are the school districts that would be the biggest concern about not taking it? I mean, would this be lower income schools or?
No, I think each district knows their operations, and they're going to just have to look at the program and look how the models would work, whether it's on a comparable basis or the governor's framework basis, and just make that call on a case-by-case basis. Again, I'm confident that when school districts, by the time this third year rolls around, they'll see how effective the program is, and they will all want to get in the program. And again, if they have the ability to have that comparable model and working with the Department of Education, who is going to be highly motivated to make sure all school districts are in the program, I'm confident they'll be able to work a system that works for them.
And Senator Kornbach.
I think that rural schools are going to be in some difficulty as far as implementing the governor's plan is concerned. Like I say, it's a very detailed plan, and I think it's something that would work okay for large districts. But rural districts, they need more choice. They need the variety of choice that we're providing in our proposal.
And when will you guys be sitting down next to talk about any kind of a compromise here?
As soon as possible.
As soon as possible. Okay, thanks so much to Senator Herman Kornbach of Ames, a Democrat, and to Representative Ron Jorgensen, a Republican from Sioux City. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
River
Thank
to
you.
River is produced by Sarah Bowden, Emily Woodbury, and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Production assistance today from John Pimble. Podcasting and on-demand audio of River to River are available at iowapublicradio.org. We always welcome your comments and questions about this program. Contact us at any time at rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by the River Monks. I'm Clay Masters. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.